Well, this would be considered week number 9. Although we have had a couple weeks that we have not met, this would be the 9th class. We're in Psalm chapter 55. We started Psalm 55 last week, remembering some of the background, some of what was happening in this chapter in verse number 3, because the voice of the enemy, because of the oppression of the wicked. Back to where we were. We're looking at a reminder, going back in review of Psalm 55, verse 3, because the voice of the enemy, because the oppression of the wicked, for they cast iniquity upon me, and in wrath they hate me. David experienced, obviously, a lot of this form of hatred. Whenever you're going to be in a leadership position, you're going to experience that. David experienced that as a king. We often in ministry experience that the more responsibility you have in a position somewhere, the more opportunity you have to make enemies. And David experiences that. And even on a more personal note, we're going to find out as we get a little bit further along into verses number 12 and 13 and 14, that it hits home as not just people who don't like us that hurt us, but actually people who we are very close with. So let's go into verse number 12. For it was not an enemy that reproached me, David says, then I could have borne it. Neither was it he that hated me that did magnify himself against me. Then I would have hid myself from him. But it was thou, a man mine equal, my guide and mine acquaintance. We took sweet counsel together and walked into the house of God in company. Now David does not inform us, neither does the overview or the title in the psalm tell us exactly who we're talking about here, but obviously David felt it to be important enough and someone close enough to him to make mention of this directly in his writing. It seems that the closer we get to people, the more those people can hurt us. David here could have been speaking of many people. David's attitude remained forgiving throughout most of his life. Those that were close to him did tend to hurt him, as is true for all of us. I've just given you 4 examples of people in David's life that are obvious ones in which David got hurt because of the relationship. Number 1, his son Absalom rebelled against him and would have killed him. That's his own son, his own family member. In his way of doing things, thought he could run the country better and was going to do all that he could to make that happen, to the point where he would have killed his own dad if he could have, if he could have gotten his hands on him. And so his own son rebels against him. And beyond what many parents experience in rebellion with their teenagers, this is what David experiences to the fullest extent, to where his son was trying to kill him. Number 2, Joab disobeyed his direct order and killed his son, Absalom. If you remember, David said, whatever you do, please save my son's life. And Absalom obviously was found hanging from a tree. His hair got caught in a tree. And some of the men were not willing to kill him because of David's command. And David told the whole military this is what he wanted to have happen. And yet Joab said, that's too bad. He's the enemy and we're going to take his life. And Joab, although he was a direct, he was in direct rebellion to what David wished, the other side of this thing that we have to remember is Joab's primary job was to protect the life of the king. And Joab probably swore to that and took an oath that he would do everything he could to protect the king. And if you can imagine having an opportunity to take someone out, if you are in that position to take someone out when the opportunity arises, Joab, although he should not have done it, at the same time it's hard to fault him in protecting the life of the king who he was living for. Number 3, his counselor Ahithophel joined Absalom's rebellion against him in 2 Samuel 15. So one of his primary counselors that would give him counsel in life and how to run the kingdom and what he thought was best, he turned against him. And then the last one is King Saul. His own father-in-law tried to kill him over and over and over again. Those are just 4 of the many things that David had people hurt him in. If you sit and ponder for a few moments, you'll think of many more, whether it was his wife, Michael, who turned against him. And on down the list, there's many more. Now, the one exception, I want you to look at this with me. David remained forgiving throughout his life, except for this, well, at least this one that we know of. Look with me in 2 Samuel 19. In spite of all the hurts that David was experiencing, he was willing to overlook these things. Even as a king, he was willing to overlook them and what we would say forgive. Now, you might remember the situation in chapter number 19 of 2 Samuel. Shimei was one who, when David was running from his son, Shimei took stones up and was throwing them at David because he saw David as the losing side at that point. And he thought, this is my opportunity to make a point. And he was picking up stones and throwing them and throwing dirt and all that. And David's men basically looked at David and said, should we kill him? And David said, not today. This is not the day. Let's just get out of town, basically was his response. But in verse 19, it says, said to the king, now this is after David returns. His son has been killed in the rebellion. David is returning to the city. And this is what Shimei says, let not my lord impute iniquity unto me, neither do thou remember that which thy servant did perversely the day that my lord the king went out of Jerusalem, that the king should take to his heart, take it to his heart. For thy servant doth know that I have sinned. Therefore, behold, I am come the first this day of all the house of Joseph to go down to meet my lord the king. Now, obviously, we can all question his motive. He knew that if he was going to live very long, that he better do something about asking forgiveness or coming to David and telling him he was sorry for what he did. Regardless, he does this and he says, he was basically the first one to meet David. He said, David, what I did was wrong. And I hope that you'll forgive me and overlook me and don't impute my sin to me. And as you read down, David said in verse 22, what have I to do with you, sons of Zeruiah, that you should this day be adversaries unto me? Shall there any man be put to death this day in Israel? For do not I know that I am this day king over Israel? Therefore the king said unto Shimei, thou shalt not die. And the king sware unto him. So David promised, he said, you're not going to die. Okay, I have basically forgiven what you have done. I have dropped it off. I'm not going to worry about it, and neither should you. Now jump over to 1 Kings chapter number 2. David giving his final words to his son, and he's going to give him some commands and some things that he wants him to remember in his kingdom. We see in verse number 1, now the days of David drew nigh that he should die, and charged Solomon his son, saying, I go the way of all the earth, be thou strong, therefore, and show thyself a man. And he gives him some commands, some things that he wants him to remember, and some things he wants him to take care of for him. Verse number 8, behold, thou hast with thee Shimei, the son of Gera, a Benjamite, which cursed me in the day with a grievous curse, in the day that I went to Mahanaim. And he came down to meet me at Jordan, and I swear to him by the Lord, saying, I will not put thee to death. Now he adds in this, with the sword. I don't know if that's how he is trying to soothe his conscience over this thing. That was not in his original statement that we just read in Samuel. Now therefore, hold him not guiltless, for thou art a wise man, and knowest what thou oughtest to do unto him. But this whorehead bring thou, but his whorehead bring down to the grave with blood. And David slept with his fathers. The very final words that David spoke on earth. Words of vengeance, anger, hatred. And David was not forgiving in this matter, although he swore unto Shimei that he would not take his life. And obviously, in a form, he didn't. He told his son to. So David probably, in his way, in his own mind, was soothing himself, his conscience. But really, as we learned in his sin with Bathsheba and killing Uriah the Hittite, God held him just as responsible. He said, you killed him with a sword, although David never picked up a sword to kill him. And so God, I'm sure, if he held him responsible in Uriah, the situation with Uriah, I'm sure he held him responsible here in the situation with Shimei. And so David was forgiving as we read down through this psalm in chapter 55, but at the same time, his final words on earth were ones of bitterness. And that's kind of a sad way to go, and hopefully you and I will not have those kind of final words to speak. And by the way, we never know when our final words are. And so, you know, the day when we leave our home, let's make sure that our final words every time we leave our home are positive, encouraging, the final time we leave work, school, whatever it is, we ought to make sure, because we never know when it's our final words. We may not get the privilege of a deathbed experience that David had, where he could sit there and say, okay, now let me think. Is there anybody I ought to forgive? Is there anybody I ought to give forgiveness to, or that I ought to have come and rectify a situation? We may not get that kind of situation like David did. So let's be careful of that. Consider also Jesus Christ, whom David typifies in many ways. His family disbelieved him, John chapter 7, verse 5. His own brothers made fun of him and mocked him. Judas betrayed him, and Jesus considered him a friend in Matthew 26:50. Peter denied him 3 times. All the disciples forsook him in Mark 14:50. And God the Father turned away from when he was on the cross. So Jesus Christ experienced these same hurts that David is experiencing with those that were closest to him. On page number 81 at the top, one song puts it this way: why did it have to be a friend that chose to betray the Lord? And why did he use a kiss to show them? That is not what a kiss is for. Only a friend can betray a friend. A stranger has nothing to gain. Only a friend gets close enough to cause so much pain. And that is true for us. We learn that in our relationships, that the people that we're closest to, the ones that we spend the most time with, are the ones that will hurt us the most. That's not always intentional. That's just life. You're with someone long enough, you start to learn their quirks, their frustrations. You know what buttons to push when you want to push them. If you want to get them frustrated, you know what to say, what to do, how to do it. We know what tone to use. And often, it's the people that we're closest with that we hurt the quickest, or that hurt us the quickest, or even the most often. And let's make sure that we are not the cause of that. Let's make sure that we are doing all that we can to hold those close relationships in care. Because we never know, as we mentioned a moment ago, when our last moment is. Remembering that the word Selah in this chapter was used twice in chapter, or verse number 7 and verse number 19. That brings us to the context of Second Advent. And this is what Luke 12:51 says: suppose ye that I am come to give peace on earth, I tell you nay, but rather division. For from henceforth there shall be 5 in one house divided, 3 against 2, and 2 against 3. The father shall be divided against the son, and the son against the father. The mother against the daughter, and the daughter against the mother. The mother-in-law against the daughter-in-law, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. Jesus came, and he's going to cause division. And that is true for many people as they get saved. The relationship with Christ will cause problems. People will turn against you because of that. And many of you may have experienced that for yourself. Verse number 16, as for me, I will call upon God, and the Lord shall save me. Evening and morning and at noon will I pray and cry aloud, and he shall hear my voice. Now, although prayer should not be a ritualistic time, we in modern Christianity have taken the concern to an extreme, maybe even to the point of not praying. And I know a friend of mine that years ago, we were talking, and he was of the persuasion that if he had a bad attitude about reading that day, reading his Bible, he just wouldn't read his Bible. And now you can kind of understand what he's saying, in that I don't want to do it with the wrong motives. But let's be honest, reading our Bible with a bad attitude is better than not reading our Bible at all. And praying maybe with wrong motives is still going to be better than not praying at all. We need to be careful of our motives, but at the same time, if I waited for my life to be lined up perfectly before I read and prayed, I would not do it very often. And that's not an excuse. That means that I just have to get my heart right. There are people that, knowing the importance of the Lord's Supper and the danger of taking it unworthily, they will come into a service and say, I'm not prepared spiritually to take this, therefore I'm going to abstain. I'm not going to take it. And that was not God's point in writing that. God's point was, when you come into the service and your heart is not right, you should not take unworthily, therefore get your heart right with God and then partake. And it was a motivation, and it was a way of checking our life and making sure that we were right with God. Not a way of saying, okay, well, that excuses me today out of my own safety. And same is true as we speak of this. God is not saying, hey, if your heart's not right, just don't pray. God's saying, get your heart right and then pray. And but often we take it to the opposite extreme. Peter was at prayer during the sixth hour. And the Bible's very particular about mentioning the hours of these. Cornelius was praying during the ninth hour in Acts chapter 10. And Daniel prayed three times a day, which is a regular thing for him. Because it says as he did a fourth time. The verse mentioned right in the notes. Now when Daniel knew the writing was signed, he went into his house. And his windows being open in his chamber toward Jerusalem, he kneeled upon his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he did aforetime. Daniel had a habit of praying three times a day. There's nothing wrong with that. See, we live in a very Catholic type of a world. And I grew up in a Catholic family. I grew very weary, even as a 10, 12 year old boy, not even understanding all that Catholicism was about, but going to church every Sunday doing the same exact routine. I could do it in my sleep. You come in, when you genuflect, you get back into your pew, you sit there, they sing a few songs, it's really words, they sing a few, and I could still sing a few of them for you, but I'm losing my voice, so I probably won't do that tonight. But
you can still do the prayers when you walk in, too.
Probably could. Yeah, it is. I had them all memorized. The fact was, it was a very ritualistic type of a thing. And people, you could do it without thinking. And understanding that in Christianity, we don't want to just dumbly pray, Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done as earth as in heaven, give us this day. You don't want to just, that's not what that prayer was given for. That was an example. And we don't want to get caught into praying just ritualistic, memorized prayers. Prayer ought to be from our heart. At the same time, there's not a problem, there's not anything sinful about praying certain times of day. So often, we just say, I'll pray when I think of it, but the problem is we get so busy, and we get so into our routine that we could get to the end of the day and go, wow, whoa, where did the day go? And where, not the day go, but the day, D-A-Y, go, where did that day go? And where, you know, where was my time? What did I do for the Lord? And we don't want that to happen. So four examples right here. In our text, evening and morning and at noon will I pray. We have Peter praying during the sixth hour, which was an hour of prayer. Cornelius was praying during the ninth hour. And Daniel prayed three times a day. And maybe we ought to set our alarm clocks or our watches to go off at a certain time to remind us whatever it takes for us to be people of prayer. I think it's a good idea. And another note on that, fasting is one of those reminders, a built-in reminder. When you're not eating and all of a sudden your stomach starts to growl and you get hungry, that's your little internal alarm clock. Pray. Remember to pray. And so it's a good idea to do that as well. Verse number 19, God shall hear and afflict them. Even he that abideth of old, Selah, because they have no changes, therefore they fear not God. He hath put forth his hand against such as that be at peace with him. He hath broken his covenant. And again, speaking this, for the most part, of the second advent, Antichrist is going to speak great words to people and deceive many. And I give you the Daniel 9:27 verse, which speaks of that. And you want to come into modern terminology or modern time, 2 Peter 2:3 says, with feigned words they will make merchandise of you. And there are people out there that will use their words to deceive us. And we need to be careful. We need to know the Word of God so that that does not happen to us. Verse 21, the words of his mouth were smoother than butter, but war was in his heart. Boy, that's an incredible verse. His words were smoother than butter, but there was war in his heart. His words were softer than oil, yet they drawn swords. The man that David wrote of spoke smoothly, yet was deceitful. He knew how to say the right thing to make people think of him and to follow his leadership, think more of him and follow his leadership. The same is true of the Antichrist in the tribulation. And the same is true in the time that we live today. And a couple of verses to just remind us of that, given at the bottom of page number 81. Verse number 22, "Cast thy burden upon the Lord, and he shall sustain thee. He shall never suffer the righteous to be moved." This is New Testament repeated in 1 Peter 5, 7, "Casting all your care upon him, for he careth for you." And Jesus reminds us in Matthew 11, 30, that we should take his burden upon us, for it is light. We do try everything, I would imagine, in trying to get things done in our life before we go to the Lord. Maybe the concerns or the problems that we have, we try and work them out. The Lord says, cast thy burden upon him. And do that in prayer. It's interesting that in 1 Peter 5, 7, it says, "Casting all your care upon him, for he careth for you. Be sober," verse 8 says, "be vigilant, for your adversary the devil, as a roaring lion, walketh about, seeking whom he may devour." And what that teaches us in the context is that, you know, when we start to doubt God's care for us, casting all your care upon him, for he careth for you, when you start to doubt whether God cares, the devil's right beside you. And he's the one speaking that. Be sober, be vigilant, be aware that the devil is right there. He's trying to get to you. And then one of the first things he's going to try and do is get you to doubt the care of God. Does God really care for me? And we're going to see that a little bit more as we go through another one of our chapters tonight, or next week if we don't get to it, in the fact that so often we begin to go through difficulties and we start to wonder if God is really paying attention. Some of the Psalms say, "Arise, O Lord," or "Awaken, O Lord." How long are you going to sleep, Lord? And God's not sleeping. The fact is that he's not working necessarily on our timetable. And we start to wonder, we start to question whether God cares. And you might remember in the boat when Jesus went down into the hinder part of the boat, fell asleep, and they hit a storm. Jesus slept through the storm, the peace of God that passes all understanding. He was able to sleep through that storm. And the disciples came and woke him up. And what was their first? "Carest thou not that we perish?" That was their first statement to him. In other words, you don't care that we're going to die. Wake up. Why are you sleeping in a time of our calamity? Well, he was in the same calamity that they were in. And there's a lot of things they forgot. Number one, he said, "Let's go to the other side." So faith would have said, "Hey, we're not going to drown because Jesus said we're going to the other side." Number two, Jesus had to make it to Jerusalem to die. And he told them that too. Their brains did not comprehend that though. We're not going to look at chapter 56, but it's interesting that it is also credited to a time when the Philistines took David. Chapter 34 of the book of Psalms also speaks to that. And it's great, again, when you have an opportunity to understand why these chapters were written. But David, remembering that he ran to the Philistines to protect himself from King Saul, and when he realized how dumb of an idea it was, he started to act insane, started to drool upon himself, started to scratch at the gate, and like an insane man. And that is the context of 56 and 34. And he says in verse number 3 of chapter 56, "What time I am afraid, I will trust in thee." That was his prayer to the Lord during that time, when all of a sudden he realized this was not such a good idea. And this might be the end of me if God does not take care of me in this situation. If you look back in chapter 34 real quick, just a couple verses to find of interest in regards to that as well, as we did not cover that. But he says, "This poor man," in verse 6, "this poor man cried, and the Lord heard him, and saved him out of all of his troubles. The angel of the Lord encampeth round about them that fear him, and delivereth them. O taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man that trusteth in him." And David, during his time standing at that wall, at that gate, man, he started, in his mind, he said, "This poor man cried, this idiot, this dummy." And boy, we probably all could say that at some point. "This poor man cried, and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all of his troubles." And then he mentions that the angel of the Lord encamped around about him to protect him. That's a great thing. God knows before we do when we need to be rescued. And God was there for him. That'll bring us to chapter number 57. We have to the chief musician, Altasheath, Michtam, of David when he fled from Saul in the cave. So immediately we get the context of this chapter. This is both an imprecatory and a praise psalm. Selah shows up in this chapter in both verses 3 and 6. The word Altasheath in the title means destroy not. Now this points to two different things. Number one, David in his prayer to the Lord, Lord, rescue me from King Saul. Don't let him destroy me. But also the other side of the coin was David saying, we are not going to destroy Saul. They had an opportunity in this cave to do that very thing, and we'll see that. David had respect for the office of the king and preserved Saul's life from the plan of David's men. His men said to him, behold, I will deliver thine enemy into thine hand, that thou mayest do to him as it shall seem good unto thee. That's what David's men said as they were standing in this cave with an opportunity to kill King Saul. The total context of the psalm is found in chapter 24 of 1 Samuel. Let's quickly turn there just to get a little bit of a reminder, an idea as we get into this chapter to give us a flavor for what David was writing about. Verse number 24, it came to pass when Saul was returned from following the Philistines that it was told him, saying, behold, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi. Saul took 3,000 chosen men out of all of Israel, and he had that leisure to him to choose all the best men that he could find to take with him. Saul, technically, if God's hand was not on David, Saul should have been able to kill David with no problem. He went to seek David and his men upon the rocks of the wild goats. All of this land probably being the land that David took and journeyed through with as a shepherd and taking care of his sheep. David knew these areas very well, and that's why he was able to hide here so quickly. He came to the sheep cotes, by the way, where it was a cave, and Saul went in to cover his feet, and that simply means he was relieving himself. He was going to the bathroom. You can look in Judges 3:24 to see that. David and his men remained in the sides of the cave, and the men of David said unto him, behold, the day of which the Lord said unto thee, behold, I will deliver thine enemy into thine hand, that thou mayest do to him as it shall seem good unto thee. Then David arose. This is how close he was to King Saul sitting in this cave. David arose and cut off the skirt of Saul's robe privily. He was close enough to be able to grab a part of his garment, and he cut it with one of his knives that he had sitting there, and he removed himself back into the hiding spot, the darkness of the cave where he was. That's how close he was. He could very easily have taken the life of Saul. But look at how his conscience bothered him in verse 5. It came to pass afterward that David's heart smote him because he cut off Saul's skirt. And he said to the men, and this is him getting right with his men, realizing that he was a bad example to them. He said, Lord forbid that I should do this thing unto my master, the Lord's anointed, to stretch forth mine hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Lord. And David believed this all the way to the end. When Saul was killed on the Mount Gilboa, and a man came running to give him news, and he was celebrating that Saul was dead, and he took credit for killing Saul, and David had that man killed. So David said, you're not going to touch the Lord's anointed, even though the Lord's anointed was trying to kill him. And so that is the background of this text in chapter 57. So David is going to write that with that in mind. Keep that in the back of your mind as we read through this, of what David was going through in the cave. Be merciful unto me, O God, be merciful unto me. And that should be our prayer as well. For my soul trusteth in thee, yea, in the shadow of thy wings will I make my refuge, until these calamities be overpassed. And David knew that this was a very dangerous situation, and he was praying, until these calamities be overpassed, he was going to be a man of prayer. He was going to pray himself through this. Great fear had overcome David as one that had been hunted down like a hunter after prey. He was being hunted down by King Saul. Now he was so close that he can hear Saul breathing. David prays in his heart for God to have mercy on him and deliver him. And that's what David is looking for. He could have taken matters into his own hands. How could Saul have happened upon the very cave that David was hiding in? With all the possible options, it could have been God stretching David's faith, or it could have been Satan putting David's faith to the test. Either way, David did what we all should do, and he turned to God in prayer. He turned to God as a chick would turn to his mother hen for refuge from danger. And that's what David says, under the shadow of thy wings. And that was the implication of that. That's what he was alluding to. I will cry unto the most, unto God most high, unto God that performeth all things for me. He shall send from heaven and save me from the reproach of him that would swallow me up, Selah. God shall send forth his mercy and his truth. And as we read earlier in Psalm 34, that God many times will do that through his angels. Psalm 91:11, excuse me, on the sidelines, for he shall give his angels charge over thee to keep thee in all thy ways. And Jesus quoted that and alluded to that during his temptation. There are many times that God sends his angels to protect his people. We are told that the angels are ministering spirits in verse Hebrews 1:14, sent forth to minister for them who shall be heirs of salvation. God's angels surrounded his prophet Elijah in 2 Kings 6:17. That is missing in your notes. Somehow that I think it is. mine ended in Elijah in and did not give the text, and so I must have missed that somehow. And 2 Kings 6:17. I'll just give it credit to my secretary again. One of the explanations by John Kitto in regards to these caves, his description near the bottom of this, it's an immense natural cavern. Now, this may not be the exact place where David was, but there were a few of these caves available and still can be seen more than likely to this day. But this is one that had been visited. The mouth can be approached only on foot along the side of a cliff. He mentions two people who visited it without being aware that it was more than likely, we should say, the reputed cave of Adullam. They stated that it runs by a long, winding, narrow passage with small chambers or cavities on either side. We soon came to a large chamber with natural arches of great height. From this last, there were numerous passages leading in all directions, occasionally joined by others at right angles, in forming a perfect labyrinth, which our guides assured us had never been perfectly explored, the people being too afraid of losing themselves. The passages are generally 4 feet high by 3 foot wide and were on all level with each other. And so these caves were not just like, in my mind, when I was always imagining this cave, it was just a, you know, this big open expanse in this one area. You walk in and, you know, there might be some rocks and David's cowering behind a rock, you know, and there's King Saul sitting right there. This, more than likely, they were probably off in a side cavern, yet close enough to be able to see. Now, David had all of his men with him, so there was a number of people there with him. David had these men so trained that even in a cave of that size, being close enough to King Saul to where they could hear him and see him, that they never made enough noise for Saul to even suspect anything was happening. In verse number 4, he says, my soul is among lions, and I lie even among them that are set on fire, even the sons of men whose teeth are spears and arrows, and their tongue a sharp sword. Satan is described as a roaring lion, always watching for an opportunity to prey upon God's people. We learned in Psalm 22, the prophetic psalm of Christ, that Jesus experienced the same warfare. Verse 13 says, they gaped upon me with their mouths as a ravening and a roaring lion. In regards to Christ, it could have been speaking of Satan, the religious leaders at the foot of the cross, or both. In the midst of that, David's faith will let him sleep among them that are set on fire. And a couple other psalms I mentioned that have said something similar to that. It says, I lay me down and slept, and I waked, for the Lord sustained me. I will both lay me down in peace and sleep, for thou, Lord, only makest me dwell in safety. And through all these problems, David was able to get a good night's rest because he learned how to trust in the Lord. I was just reading this week a young pastor in New York City that was a guest speaker at camp when I was working at Life Action. And he wrote his testimony online of what had happened to him recently. He took over the pastorate of a mid-sized church in New York City. And he experienced some really strange things. He didn't know what happened. First, he was at a conference. He started feeling extreme sharp pains in his head, starting at the back of his head, working all the way toward the front. He said it was like someone was stabbing a knife through. He said he was able to get home, and he said before he knew it, the side of his body started going numb, and he could barely feel anything. And he called his doctor. The doctor said, hey, look, if things get worse, if things get worse, come in on Monday. And he said things got worse really quick, and they ended up calling an ambulance. By the time the ambulance got there, he was completely paralyzed, his whole body paralyzed. The only thing he could do was he was still cognizant of what was going on, but he couldn't respond in any way. And he ended up swallowing his tongue. He started choking on his tongue. He couldn't even tell anybody. And he went through all this experience, and he ended up having 7 strokes. This guy is probably 3-4 years older than myself. He had 7 strokes over a couple-day period of time. He would start to recover, and all of a sudden he would feel tingling again. His side of his body would start going numb, and he'd go into a full-fledged stroke. And he still has some problems due to that, obviously, but he's recovered for the most part. But reading his testimony, how he, as he was laying there paralyzed, the only thing he could do was think and watch what was going on without responding to the doctors, without being able to say anything to his wife. All he could do was sit there, and he said, I started going through my memory verses. And he started, as many as I could. And he said he was awake all night. I mean, obviously, he said he could feel everything they were doing. All the pokes and the prodding, he just couldn't respond. But he said that sustained him to be able to keep going through his verses. And for weeks, it was just a terrible experience of what he was going through. No, well, they say that he has very small blood vessels in his head, and very thin and small, and he was just getting clots. He's on a blood thinner now and all that stuff. But nonetheless, he still has to take care of himself to and limit himself as to what he does. But to read his testimony, I had to sit there and go, wow, I don't know. I mean, none of us know how we'll respond to that kind of a thing. We might think highly of ourselves until we get into a situation like that. And to see him respond in the way he did was very encouraging and very convicting to me. And David is saying basically the same thing. I've gone through all these problems. The Lord sustained me. I was able to sleep at night. And he learned to trust in the Lord. Be thou exalted, verse 5. O God above the heavens, let thy glory be above all the earth. They have prepared a net for my steps. My soul is bowed down. They have digged a pit for me, into the midst whereof they are fallen themselves. Selah. And understanding that they had no modern weapons or firearms, and as mentioned in the notes, the ancients were much more skillful in the use of snares, nets, and pits for capturing wild animals. And we even saw that in that... Boy, that missionary movie, Itau? Is that, I think it was Itau, where they caught that wild pig. Have you all seen Itau? No one in here? You the only one seen that, Itau? Oh, you're missing out if you haven't seen Itau. Basically, it's a New Tribes missionary going into the jungles of Papua New Guinea and having them never even know what God or the name God, and they went in and started gradually helping them to, learning the culture, helping them to understand, and giving them God talk, and they started, that's what they called it, God talk, and they started Genesis, worked all the way up very patiently over a long period of time, working toward the gospel. And by the time they got to the gospel, this tribe just started catching on, and realizing that they were sinners, and the whole tribe just got, just miraculously, you can't even, it'll make you cry. It's an amazing thing to watch. You've got to see it. And maybe sometime we'll be able to do that. That'd be a fun thing to do. But anyway, that's just an amazing thing. But we saw that in there. They use these nets to capture wild animals. He says, my heart is fixed, O God. My heart is fixed. I will sing and give praise. David was appealing to the songs he had written and played over the years. His praise to the Lord for strength and encouragement. Our hearts can go through phases, up and down, as we face struggles. Notice the descriptions given in this chapter. My soul trusteth in thee, in verse 1. Then he goes downward. My soul is among lions, in verse 4. In verse 6, my soul is bowed down. Then in verse 7, my heart is fixed. It's like a roller coaster ride up and down that David is experiencing. And we can associate with that, I'm sure. Music can provide encouragement for us. In the Old Testament, whenever the children of Israel were going to battle, they would use instruments of praise to lead the way before the soldiers. I give an example in 2 Chronicles chapter 20. Give an example of Joshua chapter 6 that was used in Jericho. And there are obviously many others. And it says that the Lord set ambushments against the children of Ammon in 2 Chronicles when they began to sing and to praise. And that's an amazing testimony. And music can hold that for us if we know how to do that. And if we're careful about the music that we choose, music can be a very big encouragement and help to us. And David was going back to his victories. He was saying, my heart is fixed, O God, I will sing and give praise. He's looking back to what God had done in his life in the past, and it was an encouragement to him. Why don't we take our break, and we'll come back to verse number 8 on page number 84 in just a couple moments. We're almost at Psalm 59, so we just got this last verse, verse number 8, which I have up. And David says, awake up, my glory, awake, psaltery and harp. I myself will awake early. And here David prays for his glory to awaken. And simply what he's saying is for the glory of his past victories, he's looking to those for an encouragement in faith. A couple things that will increase our faith. One, we know to be reading the Word of God and spending time in the Word of God, according to the book of Romans. The other thing is experience. When you and I experience God doing something for us, it bolsters our faith. I bet you that Peter, even though he started to sink, when he started walking on water, I bet you his faith went up a little bit. And maybe even the guys sitting in the boat that were watching, maybe their faith went up a little bit. Not enough to get out, but at least they sat there and said, boy, he did it, and look, he didn't fall. So experience is also a big help to us. And David is saying, hey, I mean, he probably often, when he encouraged himself, went back and thought about the time he slayed the lion. He took out Goliath. He took out a bear protecting his sheep. And that encouraged him to know that God was with him and God could do more for him. 1 Samuel 12:24 says, only fear the Lord and serve him in truth with all your heart, for consider how great things he hath done for you. That considering of those great things will be an encouragement. Then he says, awake, psaltery, and harp. David here is asking for a new song. And boy, I sure hope that the people that are writing songs today are praying to God to get their music and to get their words. That's what David was doing. He said, awake, psaltery, and harp. Give me, Lord, give me something that I can write of. He said in Psalm 40, verse 3, and he hath put a new song in my mouth, even praise unto our God. Many shall see it and fear, and shall trust in the Lord. David said, this is the effect of my music, my song, my life song. He said, many shall see it and fear, and shall trust in the Lord. And that's not really, to be honest with you, the effects of much of the music in modern day culture. Basically, it's just duplicating what the world does and changing the words a little bit. Not much. Because most songs today, you'll notice they excuse themselves by saying he, him, you, and never mentioning that it's God. And this, all these songs can duplicate as a love story or a love song to someone. And it's so watered down and weak. And that's not what David's talking about. David said, the music that I do, it will have an effect. Many will see it, fear, and trust in the Lord. And that's what music should do. And again, this is a reminder that we need to be careful of that in the music that we pay attention to and listen to. He wanted a song of praise regarding the goodness and protection of God in the midst of yet another problem. David would pray for God's direction in writing his music. Then he said, I myself will awake early. David's faith is already encouraged through his prayers. He plans to wake up early the next morning with this song. He has confidence that he will make it through another night to see another morning. And so David, in his prayer, awake my glory, in praying and trying to bolster his faith, and he finally says, I myself will awake early. I will make it through another night. And that's how David encouraged himself in the Lord. That brings us to chapter number 59. And the title says, to the chief musician, Altashef, Mitchum of David, when Saul sent, and they watched the house to kill him. And another interesting situation in the life of David is King Saul wanted to kill him, and he sent his men to the house, and they were waiting outside the door to kill David. And you might remember, let's look quickly over there to get the context, 1 Samuel 19. We'll read just a couple of these verses. Verse number 11, Saul sent messengers unto David's house to watch him and to slay him in the morning. And Michal, David's wife, told him, saying, if thou save not thy life tonight, tomorrow thou shalt be slain. In other words, if you don't leave this house tonight, you'll be dead in the morning. So Michal let David down through a window, and he went and fled and escaped. And Michal took an image, which I'm not quite sure why she would have one of those in David's house, but she had an image, something that she would worship or give praise to, laid it in the bed, and took a pillow of goat's hair for his bolster and covered it with a cloth. So it looked like there was someone in the bed. There was an image there under the covers, and it really was not David. It was this image. When Saul sent messengers to take David, she said, he is sick. And Saul sent the messengers again to see David, saying, bring him up to me in the bed, that I may slay him. If he's so sick that he can't come himself, just carry his bed with him. And when the messengers were come in, behold, there was an image in the bed with a pillow of goat's hair for his bolster. And Saul said unto Michal, why hast thou deceived me so, and sent away mine enemy, that he is escaped? And Michal answered Saul, he said unto me, let me go, why should I kill thee? And so she made up a story, saying that David threatened her life, therefore she had to let him go. So this is the background in which David is writing this. We're never told that the psalm is written at the very moment of this event, which really is not possible at the very moment, or in light of it, looking back, months later. But either way, David shows an extreme calmness in life. He's beginning to, not that he's not afraid, not that he's not brought to prayer through his experiences, but at the same time, David is starting to stay a little bit more calm. You know, there are some people that go through absolute panic mode when something bad happens. They scream and they lose control of their bodily functions, And, over time, you start to grow a little more accustomed to stuff. I'm sure there are a lot of doctors and nurses that the first time they see an operation, they pass out and people have to pick them up off the floor. And over time, they kind of get used to the stuff. They get a little more comfortable with it. And that's what's happening with David. He's becoming a little more used to these problems. It doesn't change the fact that he still goes to prayer, but the fact is he's still calm. He writes a psalm. He writes a song in light of his experience of almost being killed again. He says in verse 1, deliver me from mine enemies, O God. Defend me from them that rise up against me. Deliver me from the workers of iniquity, and save me from bloody men. For lo, they lie in wait for my soul. The mighty are gathered against me, not for my transgression, nor for my sin, O Lord. And David said, I didn't do anything to deserve this. I mean, I've been living the right way. And if you read in Samuel, you'll find out that David, it says of David that he went out and came in before the people wisely. He knew how to act. He knew how to present himself. He was living the way he was supposed to, and yet he was experiencing these many problems. David was complaining because there was nothing he could think of in his life that he did to earn the hard times he is experiencing. Not all things that happen in life are because of sin. There are actually a number of things that can cause us difficult times in our lives, and I've listed just a few of them. Number one, for God to receive glory. That is one of the things. John 11:4, Jesus heard it. He said, this sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God might be glorified thereby. And so sometimes we experience problems so that God can receive glory when things start going right again. Number two, that the works of God could be seen by all. That in John 9:2. He said in verse 3, neither hath this man sinned nor his parents, but that the works of God should be made manifest in him. Number three, to minister to others through our experience. 2 Corinthians 1:4, who comforteth all our us in all our tribulation, that we may be able to comfort them which are in any trouble by the comfort wherewith we ourselves are comforted of God. There are situations and problems that you and I will go through just for the reason that you and I can minister to someone else. I don't like the fact that my parents were divorced when I was very young. And I still don't. I'm still not like, oh, this is fantastic. I'm so glad it happened. But you know what? Due to that, my dad got remarried and in so doing got saved. And that led to me getting saved. It led to my sister getting saved. Our families have come to know Christ. So things worked out for good. I'm still not excited about that happening. But you know what? It also gives me an opportunity to minister to teenagers whose parents have divorced. I know what they're going through. I don't understand all of the different situations and all that to add it up to it. But I understand the basic feeling of that. I know what that's like. My mom died when I was 15. I can minister to people who lose their parents. All of those things, those experiences that you and I have, are ministry opportunities. And we have to remember that. Sometimes we get so, you know, woe is me. We pat ourselves on the back and we have a pity party. And there's always someone that's had it worse than us, but we can always turn that into a ministry. And that's an important thing. We live in a sinful world that is degenerating. That's the fourth reason why we suffer. We suffer, number five, because of our own sin, our own stupidity, the dumb things that we do, and the consequences of that. And number six, we suffer to learn not to trust in ourselves, but rather in God. But we had the sentence of death in ourselves, Paul said, that we should not trust in ourselves, but in God which raiseth the dead. And that's an important lesson for us to learn. Thou therefore, O Lord, in verse 5, Lord God of hosts, the God of Israel, wake to visit all the heathen. Be not merciful to any wicked transgressor. And again, David speaking and praying that God would awaken. We know he's not asleep, and sometimes it just feels like he is. This is the harsh part of an imprecatory psalm or prayer. David is praying against the enemy with great detail. Paul did the same thing. We've mentioned this before in Galatians, where he said, I wish they were even cut off, which trouble you. The wicked of this text are pointing to the wicked of Daniel chapter 11 in the Great Tribulation, with Selah ending that verse. And so David is praying against them, not only for himself, but futuristically speaking, prophetically, of the tribulation. Verse number 10, the God of mercy shall prevent me or go before me. God shall not see my desire. God shall let me see my desire upon mine enemies. David was waiting on God when went on the run from Saul. He did so because of his strength, having all the resources of a king at his disposal. And that would bring some worries and concerns to you if your enemy had all of the things available to them that King Saul did. There were a number of times that David could have risen up and tried to fight. Before David would even have a chance to fight in his own behalf, God would run before him and fight for him. And that's what he's saying. God shall prevent me. God will go before me. David never raised a sword against Saul, as God brought Saul to the point of taking his own life on Mount Gilboa. David never truly had to fight against Saul. That'll bring us to Psalm chapter number 60. Hopefully all of you have the notes as we get to this chapter. In our overview, this is in the title, it's to the chief musician. And again, a psalm of David used to teach. And so this is a didactic psalm, as is given in the title. This is a psalm to teach. Overview, Selah shows up in verse 4, and it would be considered a didactic psalm, as it informs in the title. The main context is found in 2 Samuel chapter number 8. Those that David killed in this conquest are found in 1 Chronicles 18:5. Another 12,000 of Ishtab under Joab in 2 Samuel 12:6. That's an assumed thing. And so that's the background, if you were to look at 2 Samuel 8, as to what David is saying in this psalm. Verse number 1. Thou hast cast us off, thou hast scattered us, thou hast been displeased. O turn thyself to us again. And David's asking for God to revive them. And he'll say that again later on in another psalm, revive thy people. David understands, though, at the same time, there's a reason why God has turned from them and scattered them because he was displeased of their choices. Verse number 2, thou hast made the earth to tremble, thou hast broken it, heal the breaches thereof, for it shaketh. God's judgment during the tribulation will send the earth into a tailspin, in which even the islands will be moved. Heaven's departed as a scroll when it rolled together, and every mountain and island were moved out of their places. There'll be new waterways and valleys. I think we've mentioned that before in another chapter. At times people will be tossed around and they will reel to and fro and stagger like a drunken man at their wit's end. That's in Psalm chapter 107, verse 27. I also listed three other verses that speak of that. God will shake the heavens. And at one point, as I was just reading today in the book of Revelation, the stars of heaven will come down like a fig tree out of season. In other words, the fruit is so ripe that it just falls. The stars of heaven will do that during the tribulation. And David is speaking of that. The earth will tremble. There was another, I just heard tonight, there was another earthquake. And they say that there's more than likely a tsunami was coming out of it. I don't know if that was just on the news. Obviously, it hadn't happened yet because they didn't report it as a done deal. But that was another pretty big one, and it's over 8.4, I think I read, and which is an amazing thing that these are happening at the rate they're happening at, and to the magnitude that they're happening. There's something more to that, and of course, we don't know what God is doing, and we never can assume upon Him. Verse number 4, thou hast given a banner to them that fear thee, that it may be displayed because of the truth, Selah. That banner, and something that goes before us like a flag, like the military would have. And God wants to give that to us, a banner of victory before our enemies. That thy beloved may be delivered, verse number 5, save with thy right hand, and hear me. The beloved would speak of Israel. And the Lord's right hand would speak of Jesus Christ. Verse number 8, Moab is my washpot. Over Edom will I cast out my shoe. Philistia, triumph thou because of me. And Moab being the washpot, the Moabites will be reduced to the meanest slavery. A servant to hold the basin and to wash the feet of those who conquer them. That's basically what that's speaking of. And Moab was not a friend of Israel. And as we learn in the book of Matthew, it says, how we treat them is how we treat Jesus Christ. As you've done unto the least of them, my brethren, you've done it unto me. And Moab and Edom both treated Israel with disdain. And they will pay for that for all of eternity. In the Old Testament, when something was sold, traded, or exchanged, the buyer would give one of their shoes. And the most well-known illustration of that would be in the book of Ruth when he was assuming his rights over Ruth, and he gave his shoe at the city gates. It was kind of like signing a contract in the old days, and don't know that I want to go back to those ways of taking someone's shoe to sign a contract, but that's what they did nonetheless. And so when he says, over Edom I will cast my shoe, basically, I will make complete conquest of Idumea. He's going to take possession of that. God will take possession, by the way, of the whole world at the end. Jesus Christ will. But again, it speaks of trampling on their necks, the subject of the Edomites to the meanest offices, as well as the Moabites. God will take possession of Edom in the second advent. And so when he says he will cast his shoe, many would believe that just to mean that he's going to take possession, just as they would in the Old Testament by trading a shoe when they were buying, selling, or trading. He asked the question in verse 9, who will bring me into the strong city? who will lead me into Edom? Will not thou, O God, which didst cast us off, and thou, O God, which didst not go out with our armies? The strong city again refers to Selah, the rock city in Edom. Although God did not lead his people when the Antichrist killed them in the tribulation, he will lead them in two ways now. And the two ways listed, he will lead them, the remnant at least, in Revelation to the city of Selah. And more than likely, that probably shouldn't have an H at the end because Selah is not spelled that way as the city. And then he will lead the armies of God against Satan. And so as he speaks of that leading, God will do that in the second advent. He will lead his people. He will be on the white horse in front of his armies. Give us help from trouble, for vain is the help of man. Through God we should do valiantly, for he it is that shall tread down our enemies. God's people will not have anything to do when Christ takes vengeance on Satan and all the unbelievers. And he says he does it alone in Isaiah 63. What help could we offer God? God, let me, I'll take this guy out. I mean, what help does God really need? He takes care of it all himself. Vain is the help of man. Through God we shall do valiantly. Jesus, the only one with blood on his garments, as he pleads with unbelievers with the sword of his mouth. As the conquering king, he was clothed with a vesture dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. While his armies that follow are clothed in fine linen, white and clean, according to verse 14, for he it is that shall tread down our enemies. God will take care of all of that. Whether it's just symbolic that we are with him, we will not know. But we are obviously not needed when he returns to take vengeance on all those who have rebelled against him. He does not need our help. We are with him. We are clothed in white linens while he is in a vesture dipped in blood. Due to his trip that he takes and his vengeance that includes Moab, Edom, and some of the other cities down south of Israel, much of which, by the way, are the cities that gave Israel trouble coming out of Egypt. They did not treat Israel with the kind of respect that God wanted them to. That'll bring us to chapter number 62. Our title to the chief musician, to Jeduthun, a psalm of David. And Selah is going to show up again in verses 4 and 8 for us, again to help set our context here. Verse number 1, truly my soul waiteth upon God, from him cometh my salvation. David learned over and over again to wait on the Lord and his protection as he fled from King Saul through the wilderness of Judea. Those in the tribulation will also wait on the Lord, hoping to endure to the end as a remnant. And if you read through the book of Revelation, the middle chapters, you're going to find that so many people are killed in the tribulation, it's a miracle for anybody to survive. But there is a surviving remnant. God will rescue them. And as we see in chapter number 12, he will protect them, that remnant, from the beast. Verse number 2, he only is my rock and my salvation. He is my defense. I shall not be greatly moved. We can notice the change in this phrase, I shall not be greatly moved, when we get to verse number 6. Here, he could be swayed a little bit, just not a lot. That's basically what he's saying, I shall not be greatly moved. After speaking of God and building his confidence, he will write in verse number 6, I shall not be moved, period. Experience with God can build our confidence in the same way. We have to put ourselves in a place to see God do a miracle that only he can get credit for. Most of the time we live our lives so safely that we never see God do the impossible. And again, we poke fun at Peter for starting to sink on his water walking experience, but what about the rest of the disciples who didn't step out of the boat? And what about us? When's the last time we ventured out into an arena where only God could do something for us, where we had to rely on him? And so often we do. We just live in the safety of everyday life. We don't venture out. We don't give a track to someone who's scary looking. We're not willing to maybe say something to our boss because we might lose our job. We don't ever venture out. And I'm not saying be stupid, obviously, but there are times when after seeking the counsel of the Lord that we should try something that will stretch our faith a little bit. And David is speaking to that end. Verse number 3, how long will you imagine mischief against a man? Ye shall be slain, all of you. As a bowing wall shall ye be, and as a tottering fence. They only consult to cast him down from his excellency. They delight in lies. They bless with their mouth, but they curse inwardly. Selah. And boy, to be careful of the people that we associate with closest. People can deceive us with the words they speak. We learned that earlier. Someone who spoke smooth as butter, but war was in their hearts. And David says, they bless with their mouth, but they curse inwardly. And when he's saying curse, in other words, someone is trying to proclaim a curse upon someone, a hatred, hoping for their demise. This follows the same theme as 52, verses 3 and 4. As we see those without God delighting in the lies and deceit. This has always been the way of Satan and his children, but it will only escalate during the end times and the tribulation. Everyone, the lies will abound, and Satan himself is the father of lies. For when he speaketh a lie, he speaketh of his own, for he is a liar and the father of it. That is John 8:44. My soul, wait thou upon God, for my expectation is from him. David again talks to himself. My soul, wait thou upon God. He's speaking to himself, giving light on how he encouraged himself in the Lord his God. Sometimes it is in recounting the goodness and victories of God or claiming the promises that we know in Scripture. Selah reminds us that this prayer will be the prayer of the Jewish remnant, waiting for God to deliver them from the Antichrist. Wait thou upon God. Sometimes we just need to talk that to ourselves, to remind ourselves of that. And David learned how to do that. Verse number 11. God has spoken once, twice have I heard this, that power belongeth unto God. When God speaks once, we need to listen and take note. When God speaks twice, we better not miss it. According to Genesis 41:32, there's a reason for God repeating something. And this is what it says, and for that dream was doubled unto Pharaoh twice, it is because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass. God said, when I speak twice, you better be really paying attention. Some Bible people had their names repeated twice when God was speaking to them. Abraham in Genesis 22. Samuel, 1 Samuel 3:10. Simon in Luke 22, and Saul in Acts 9:4. Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has desired to have you, that he may sift you as wheat, Jesus said to him. And when God has to repeat something twice, there's an important thing, and something to be learned. And, you know, I guess we could take that even practically speaking, that if God says something to us in our conscience or our hearts, we ought to obey the first time. That's something all of us as parents want to see our children learn, is to obey the first time we say something. We shouldn't have to repeat ourselves. One of the gentlemen that discipled me when I was a teenager, he's at Word of Life. He's the president of Word of Life Bible Institute. And we visited him one time when he was the director of the camp, the summer camp. And we brought a group of teenagers from Michigan there, and we were able to go and spend some time with him in his house. And he has a son and a daughter, and I believe he actually has two daughters, but the younger one I don't know at all. But his son and his daughter, the older two, one was probably 15 and one was maybe 12 or so when we went to visit. And I mean, when they came in, you know, there was summertime, it was camp, they were on the island, teen camp, and life is busy and fun, and they came flying in the house, and Rick asked them to do something, and without question, they immediately did it. They had all kinds of commotion going on, they wanted to get back out to what they were doing, they did immediately what he told them, and it was so refreshing to watch. And he told us, he said, when we were raising them, he said, our philosophy was this, first time, every time. Because so often, we as parents, we grow weary in the battle, and we excuse disobedience, and we warn a second time, we give a second opportunity, and basically what we're doing is we're telling our children, you usually have two or three opportunities to do this, so you don't have to listen to me the first time. If you want to listen the second or third time, that's okay. So I'm going to speak something, and if you want to do it, go ahead. That's basically what we're teaching. And Rick's philosophy was first time, every time. He would tell them to do something. If they didn't, they got punishment, corporal punishment. And they learned that when Dad says something, he means it. I better listen. And you know what I believe that's going to happen? I believe that when God says something to his children, they're going to listen. They've learned that the response to authority is not an optional thing or something you can do when you are ready for it. It's do it when it's said. And a lot of the things that we do as parents are the same thing. It's teaching our children how to respond to God as an authority as well. And so anyway, when God speaks twice, we ought to pay attention. We ought to pay attention when God speaks one time. Jesus repeated the same thing to Peter three times in John 21. Must have been pretty important, and maybe Peter wasn't catching on. But he asked Peter three times, lovest thou me more than these? And Peter three times said yes. And three times Jesus said, then feed my sheep, serve me, do something. And remember that was right after they, 21:1, Peter said, you know what? I'm done with this stuff. I'm going fishing. And Jesus called him from fishing for fish to fish for men. Jesus died and he goes back to fishing for fish again. He quit, basically, is what it comes down to. And there was a bunch of men, of disciples, that followed with him. And the decisions that we make are going to impact other people. And a bunch of disciples followed him. They quit the ministry just the same. They went out in the boat. They caught nothing all night. Jesus was on the shore. And, hey, guys, you catch anything? They didn't recognize him. All of a sudden, after a few moments, John recognized who it was. John had a little more sense to him. And he said, hey, that is the Lord. And Peter, man, he dove in the water. He swam to shore. And Jesus already had a fire built, and he cooked some fish for them. And in that midst, right around the fire, last time that Peter saw a fire, he denied Christ three times. And now he comes to this fire, and Jesus proclaims his forgiveness to him three times. But he also says, if you do love me, then serve me. And he says it to him three different times. And so God sometimes does have to repeat things to us. Sometimes we just don't catch on, or we don't catch on fast enough. But boy, we're walking on dangerous territory when we ignore the Lord and he has to repeat something a second time. And then if he has to repeat something a third time, only God knows how many times he'll repeat something before the judgment will fall. And but he says, God has spoken once. Twice have I heard this, that power belongeth unto God. And God is the one at the ultimate authority. Don't fear them who can kill the body. Jesus said, fear him who can, after he kills the body, can also throw it into hell. That's the power of God. And sometimes we cower under what people think of us. And God says, don't worry about that. You worry about what I am concerned with. I am the one who has power and authority. Chapter number 66, another key verse overview. Just hit on some of the key aspects of this chapter. This is to the chief musician, a song or psalm. And this is, again, when we talked in the introductory material of what a psalm is, this is one of the helps to that, a song or psalm. In other words, both will do. A song is a psalm, and a psalm is a song. In the overview, Selah shows up in this chapter in verses 4, 7, and 15. Going to help us again, once again, set the context for us, being of the second advent. Make a joyful noise unto God, all ye lands. Sing forth the honor of his name. Make his praise glorious. Say unto God, how terrible art thou in thy works. Through the greatness of thy power shall thine enemies submit themselves unto thee. That is going to happen one day. The Bible tells us that one day every knee will bow and every tongue will confess. There is going to come a day when even those who are in the strongest rebellion against God, who are in witchcraft even, one day they will submit to the authority of God. We will see Satan himself submitted to the authority of Jesus Christ. And but that's what he says. How terrible art thou in thy works. Through the greatness of thy power shall thy enemies submit themselves unto thee. And God will snap his fingers and everyone will fall down before him. Another music principle is learned here. Our worship, verses 1 and 2, ought to be directed vertically toward God, not horizontally toward ourselves or each other. And as we mentioned that earlier tonight, in regards to music, this again is an important issue. That so many of the songs today are watered down, you know, they don't say Jesus Christ, they don't say God. The song can in turn be used either to be a love song. And listen, if a secular radio station is pleased to play a song that's a Christian song, there's got to be a problem. There's got to be a problem there. For them to, knowing their listening audience, and for them to grab onto a Christian song from a Christian group and play it as a top song, there must be a problem. People will say, well, that's a God thing. That's what people say. It's a God thing. God is using that song to reach people. Again, I can't find in Scripture where music is used as a form of evangelism. But we do know that if it's watered down a whole lot, as we've seen in the Psalms, in our principles here, that God is not pleased with that. The writers of Psalms wrote words that were very, and prayed about the words they were writing, and they wrote doctrinally and very sound information in their music. And now we see that our music, our songs, our worship ought to be vertical. Up and down, our worship of God, not toward each other. And we water it down a little bit too much in that. All the earth shall worship thee and shall sing unto thee. They shall sing to thy name. Although there are some that will not worship Christ during the millennium, in Zechariah 14, we've looked at that earlier weeks, eventually all the earth will when it is made new, 2 Peter 3:13, by fire. And so at one day, everyone will worship. This goes to show the wickedness of mankind. Even in the best of settings, the millennium, when we have Jesus Christ physically on the throne, which would seem to make things easy to live right, mankind still rebels against him. But one day the whole earth will worship, including creation. Come and see the works of the Lord. He is terrible in his doing toward the children of men. He turned the sea into dry land. They went through the flood on foot. There did we rejoice in him. The word terrible is used here in the sense of awesome, incredible, or unbelievable. It carries the idea of making afraid or being dreadful. The historical setting for verse 6 is the Red Sea crossing when Israel was fleeing Pharaoh and his army after the exile. There's also a prophetic application with Selah here to this verse. When Christ returns to judge the earth in righteousness, he will travel on the white horse from heaven, also described as the deep. So they went on dry land in the flood. We have just something to consider in regards to the deep being the expanse between heaven and earth. Genesis 7:11 in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, the same day were all the fountains of the deep broken up, and the windows of heaven were open. So there's water there. Genesis 8:2, the fountains also of the deep, and the windows of heaven were stopped, and the rain from heaven was restrained. chapter Psalm 104, verse 3, who layeth the beams of his chambers in the waters. His chambers in the waters. So there's water there. There's going to be a crossing. And chapter 8, verse 27 of Proverbs, when he prepared the heavens, I was there. When he set a compass upon the face of the depth, when he established the clouds above, when he strengthened the fountains of the deep. Speaking of the heavens, beginning of the verse. So we have in the heavens an expanse, water. And there's going to be a crossing. So we not only have the crossing historically of the Red Sea crossing, but we're talking prophetic here of the crossing when Jesus Christ travels on the white horse. He's going to travel through the waters of heaven. A little bit more to help us better understand this. When Job was speaking of Leviathan, the great dragon, he spoke of his trail through the great deep, leaving a path, quote unquote. Job 41:31. He maketh the deep to boil like a pot. He maketh the sea like a pot of ointment. He maketh a path to shine after him. One would think the deep to be hoary. Jesus also mentioned something similar to this in Luke 10:18. It says, he beheld Satan as lightning fall from heaven, a streak of lightning. So there was a path there. When considering how it is possible for Satan to present himself before the Lord, and this is one of the questions that comes up quite often, if sin is not allowed before God and in heaven, how does Satan present himself in the presence of God like he does in Job chapter number 1 and chapter number 2? Well, this could be explained due to Job 38:30, where it says, the waters are hid as with a stone, the face of the deep is frozen. And so we have the deep being an expanse of water in heaven, in the heavens, that Christ will pass through. And when it speaks of Satan presenting himself before God, the face of the deep, or the top of the deep, is frozen. And that would just lead us to believe that Satan, when he comes to present himself before God, is basically below this frozen portion of the deep. So when he presents himself, he's not like within touching distance of God. God is protected by the face of the deep being frozen. And so we see this expanse of water. We saw it in creation. We saw it when the flood happened. And God continues to mention it through the book of Job and through the book of Psalms, that there's an expanse of water there. God is going to pass through that when he comes. He is going to make a crossing once again. He is going to leave a trail like through the deep as he comes back in judgment. Jesus' return path will take him through the deep, where there have been wars among God's angels and Satan's angels for centuries. This may be why when Lazarus died, he was carried by angels into Abraham's bosom. It was for his protection as he went from earth to paradise. This may be true of all believers when they die. This may have been the whole context of the dispute over the body of Moses in Jude 9. So, the angels carried Lazarus to Abraham's bosom, probably a form of protection as they pass from one world to another. One of the things that we learn in studying Scripture is there are obviously more dimensions than what you and I experience right now. We experience the physical dimension. I have a feeling that if we were to experience the spiritual dimension, which happens in the book of Revelation, when all of the dimensions start to cross, the kingdom of God, kingdom of heaven, everything starts to cross over and mix, all of a sudden the people start to see the red dragon. They start to see the spiritual warfare as it really is. We learn in Daniel chapter 9 that Daniel prayed a prayer, and in his prayer, the answer was coming through an angel. The angel was hindered for 21 days because of warfare in heaven. We seem to think that because we don't see that doesn't happen right now. Just like a lot of people, we read about spiritual warfare in the Bible, We read about people being possessed with devils and being tormented by devils. And we seem to think that that's like a thing for Africa. You know, and that all happens over there, and it happened in the Bible times, but it doesn't happen here. And there's a lot of, I think there's a lot of people in hospitals. There's a lot, not all of them. Don't leave here saying that I've just, condemned everyone in a hospital to demon possession, because that's not true. But there's a lot of people that are in insane asylums, in places like that, that are being tortured even physically due to satanic attack. Just because our culture, and I'm not even going to get into this and start naming things that we call it today, but we've named everything something else. It's no longer demon possession, now it's you fill in the blank. Because if I start naming stuff, I'm going to get myself in trouble. Because there are some things that happen to people that are genuine problems. But there are other times when people experience these problems as satanic attack. I can't tell you when that is. Maybe if you sat down in a certain situation like people do in Africa, Bobby Bonner's got story upon story. He could stand in here for hours on end and tell you stories of demon possession that he has had to work with, and he's had to quote scripture through, and he's had to pray through, and people have been delivered. You might find some of those, but I'm telling you, there are people around us all the time that experience that. We may not recognize it because we've been dumbed down in America to the point where we excuse it off as mental illness or whatever we want to say, and everything has a reason and excuse and another name. We've given it other technical names, and we've excused it off. And a lot of it happens. And the same being true of this, there is spiritual warfare going on in heaven today. We may not see it. But in Revelation, all the dimensions start to cross, and all of a sudden people can see all the stuff happening. And no wonder that people are are terrified. No wonder that like men are like women in labor. They're so distressed. Their lives are falling apart. Can you imagine the fear of seeing demons all around you and knowing the spiritual warfare that you and I are protected from right now? We don't physically see it, but one day that will all open up. And that's what this is talking of, this path through the great deep. I'm sure that the angels transporting Lazarus, there was a reason for that. And maybe that's exactly what happens with all believers when they're taken to heaven. Now we don't go to Abraham's bosom. Jesus Christ has finished everything. His work is finished. He's in heaven. Believers, when they die now, they go to heaven. And maybe that's the whole thing that happens. Maybe the angels actually transport us as a protection through the heavens, crossing over because of the spiritual warfare that is happening there. And that's probably what is happening in regards to the body of Moses in Jude 9. And obviously there are other things involved in that as well. I'll give a couple examples. In Daniel 10, the one I've mentioned, Revelation chapter number 12, the spiritual warfare, war was in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought against his angels, and prevailed not, neither was there found place any more in heaven. In other words, Satan was done, and he was kicked out of heaven, and he no longer had the freedom to roam as he did all of these years. And so that's what we're looking at there with the great deep and the crossing of the flood. Let's just move quickly down verse number 18. It says, if I regard iniquity in my heart, the Lord will not hear me, but verily God hath heard me. You know what he's saying there, obviously. He's saying, if I have sin in my heart, the Lord will not hear me, but the Lord hears me right now. And that's a great proclamation. David's saying, my heart is right with God. But if I do have sin in my heart, God will not hear me. All of the promises that we have of answered prayer are hindered when you and I have sin in our heart. Not just sin outwardly, but sin in our heart. Stuff that no one else may even know about. God wants us to remember to confess all of our sin. So David was saying basically in that, I am right with God. My heart is clean. God can hear my prayers. And as I close this chapter prophetically, This could also be speaking of the 144,000 as we look at future events who had no guile in their mouth, Revelation chapter 14, verse 5, and because they did not regard iniquity in their heart either. And the 144,000 in whom was no guile, Revelation 14, 5, this could prophetically be speaking of those very people as well. And so that closes chapter number 66. And we will finish off this section next week and move into the third book of Psalms during that time.